About 2 a.m., the phone rang again, waking Hillary and me. Dick Kelly was on the line crying. He said, "She's gone, Bill." After a perfect but exhausting week, Mother had just gone to sleep and died. I knew it was coming, but I wasn't ready to let her go. Now our last phone conversation seemed too routine, too full of idle chit-chat. We had talked like people who think they have forever to talk to each other. I was aching to redo it, but all I could do was tell Dick that I loved him, that I was so grateful to him for making her last years happy, and that I'd get home as quickly as I could. Hillary knew what had happened from my end of the conversation. I hugged her and wept. She said something about Mother and her love of life, and I realized that the phone conversation was just the kind Mother would have chosen to be our last one. My mother was always about life, not death. Later that morning, we put out a release announcing Mother's death, which was all over the news immediately. By coincidence, Bob Dole and Newt Gingrich were on the morning news programs. Undeterred by the moment, interviewers asked about Whitewater. Dole replied that it, quote, cries out for the appointment of an independent counsel. I was stunned. I would have thought that even the press and my adversaries would take a time out on the day of my mother's death. To his credit, a few years later, Dole apologized to me. By then, I better understood what had happened. Washington's narcotic of choice is power. It dulls the senses and clouds the judgment. Dole was not even close to being its worst abuser. I was touched by his apology. After Mother's funeral, I left for a long-planned trip to Brussels, Prague, Kiev, and Moscow to establish a process for opening NATO's door to the Central European nations in a way that wouldn't cause Yeltsin too many problems in Russia. I was determined to do everything I could to create a Europe that was united, free, democratic, and secure for the first time in history. I had to make sure that NATO expansion didn't simply lead to a new division of Europe farther to the east. The trip was going well, advancing important American interests and building a safer, freer world. But you would have never known it back home, where the only thing the politicians and press wanted to talk about was Whitewater. I even got questions about it on my trip from the American press accompanying me. Before I left, the Washington Post and the New York Times had joined the Republicans in demanding that Janet Reno appoint an independent counsel. The only new development in recent months was that David Hale, a Republican who had been indicted in 1993 for defrauding the Small Business Administration, had said that I had asked him to make a loan to Susan McDougal for which she was ineligible. I had not done so. The standard for appointing an independent counsel under both the old law, which had expired, and the new one then being considered by Congress was, quote, credible evidence of wrongdoing. In its January the 5th editorial calling for an independent counsel in Whitewater, the Washington Post explicitly acknowledged that, quote, there has been no credible charge in this case, that either the president or Mrs. Clinton did anything wrong. Nevertheless, the Post said that the public interest demanded an independent counsel, because Hillary and I had been partners in the Whitewater real estate deal, on which we lost money, before McDougal bought Madison Guaranty, from which we had never borrowed money, and even worse, we had apparently failed to take the full tax deduction for our losses. Now, this was probably the first time in history when the flames of outrage against a politician were fanned because of money he lost, loans he didn't receive, and a tax deduction he didn't take. The consensus among my legal staff was for resisting an independent counsel, while most other advisors favored going along with the appointment. In the end, I came down on the side of asking for an independent counsel. After all, I had nothing to hide. All the endless clamor was diverting the attention of Congress and the country from our larger agenda. The next day, the White House asked Janet Reno to appoint an independent counsel. Though I had said I could live with it, I almost didn't live through it. It was the worst presidential decision I ever made. Wrong on the facts, wrong on the law, wrong on the politics, wrong for the presidency and the Constitution. Perhaps I did it because I was grieving over Mother. It took all the concentration I could muster just to do the job I had left her funeral to do. At the time, I wasn't all that worried about it because I knew I hadn't broken any laws, and I still believed that the press just wanted the truth. Within a week, Janet Reno appointed Robert Fisk, a Republican former prosecutor from New York, who would have completed his investigation in a timely way had he been left to do his job. Fisk, of course, was not allowed to finish, but I'm getting ahead of myself now. For now, agreeing to the special prosecutor was like taking aspirin for a cold. It brought temporary relief. Very temporary. In the last week of January, we had a heated debate within our foreign policy team over whether to grant a visa to Gerry Adams, leader of Sinn Féin, the political arm of the Irish Republican Army. America had great significance to both sides in the Irish conflict. For years, ardent American supporters of the IRA had provided funds for its violent activities. Sinn Féin had a larger number of partisans here among Irish Catholics who disowned terrorism, but wanted to see an end to discrimination against their co-religionists and more political autonomy with Catholic participation in Northern Ireland. The British and the Irish Protestants had their supporters, too, who deplored any dealings with Sinn Féin because of its ties to the IRA, and who believed that we had no business meddling in the affairs of the United Kingdom, our strongest ally. That argument had carried the day with all my predecessors, including those sympathetic to the legitimate grievances of Northern Ireland's Catholics. Now, with the Declaration of Principles, we had to revisit it. In the Declaration, for the first time ever, the UK pledged that the status of Northern Ireland would be determined by the wishes of its citizens, and Ireland renounced its historic claim to the six counties in the north until a majority of its people voted to change its status. The more moderate Unionist and Irish Nationalist parties were cautiously supportive of the agreement. The Reverend Ian Paisley, leader of the extreme Democratic Unionist Party, was outraged by it. Gerry Adams and Sinn Féin said they were disappointed because the principles lacked specificity as to how the peace process would operate and how Sinn Féin would be able to participate in it. Notwithstanding the ambiguous responses, the British and Irish governments clearly had created pressure on all parties to work with them for peace. From the time the declaration was issued, Adams' allies in America had been asking me to grant him a visa to come to the United States. They said it would increase his standing and his ability to get involved in the process and to press the IRA toward giving up violence. John Hume, leader of the moderate Social Democratic and Labor Party, who had built a career on nonviolent action, said he had changed his position on giving Adams a visa. He now thought it would advance the peace process. A number of Irish-American activists agreed. In early January, Irish Prime Minister Albert Reynolds informed us that, like John Hume, he now favored granting the visa because Adams was working for peace, and he felt the visa would give him leverage to move the IRA away from violence and into the peace process. The British government remained vehemently opposed to the visa. Because of the long history of IRA terror, and because Adams had neither renounced violence nor embraced the Declaration of Principles as the basis for settling the problem. National Security Advisor Tony Lake and the NSC team became convinced that Adams did favor an end to IRA violence, full participation by Sinn Féin in the peace process, and a democratic future for Northern Ireland. Their analysis only made sense. The Irish were beginning to prosper economically. Europe as a whole was moving toward greater economic and political integration, and tolerance for terrorism among the Irish had dropped. Adams knew that terror wouldn't bring victory, and he seemed genuine when he said he wanted the IRA to give it up in return for an end to discrimination against and isolation of Catholics. Based on this analysis, the NSC determined that we should grant the visa, because it would boost Adams' leverage within Sinn Féin and the IRA, while increasing America's influence with them. That was important, because unless the IRA renounced violence and Sinn Féin became a part of the peace process, the Irish problem could not be resolved. Gerry Adams came to the United States on January 31st and received a warm reception from Irish Americans sympathetic to the cause. During the visit, he promised to push Sinn Féin to make concrete, positive decisions. But afterward, the British accelerated their efforts to get political talks going with the Northern Irish parties, and the Irish government increased its pressure on Sinn Féin to cooperate. 7 months later, the IRA declared a ceasefire. The visa decision had worked. It was the beginning of my deep engagement in the long, emotional, complicated search for peace in Northern Ireland. By the end of April, it was clear that we had lost the healthcare communications battle. A Wall Street Journal NBC News poll published March 10th in an article entitled, "Many Don't Realize It's the Clinton Plan They Like," showed that when people were asked about our health plan, a majority opposed it. But when asked about what they wanted in a health plan, the major provisions that were actually in our plan were all supported by more than 60% of the people. The article said, "When the group has read a description of the Clinton bill without identifying it as the president's plan, and of the four other leading proposals in Congress, the Clinton plan is the first choice of everyone in the room." The poll authors, one Republican and one Democrat, are quoted as saying, "The White House should find this both satisfying and sobering. Satisfying because the basic ideas which they have drawn up are the right ideas in the view of many people, but sobering because they clearly have communicated very little to the public, and in that respect have ceded too much to the interest groups.